that? That's what an estimated 500 horsepower sounds like. How about that? That's a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system with 18 speakers and a Beosonic sound experience. And that, that's our legacy. You ready to be a part of it? Unlock the energy of the all-electric ZDX Type S. Order now at Acura.com.
From their innovative practice facility to unmatched views from the fairway, the PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with 5G solutions from T-Mobile for Business. Together, we're using AI-powered analytics to expand coaching tools and bringing fans closer to the pros with 5G-connected cameras. This is game-changing innovation. This is the PGA of America with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
With all the pressure around cybersecurity, I was looking for an industry to draw comparisons to. And I stumbled on first responders and emergency responders. Let's talk with Jason Hupkus about mental health in those industries. This is a bonus episode of The Business of Tech. So Jason, I was super interested to talk to you today because of your background, but there's nobody that can tell that story better than you. Tell me a little bit about sort of your career arc and how you ended up doing what you're doing now.
Yeah, well, that's a wild story that certainly goes into the weeds quickly. But kind of short summation, I have always been an entrepreneur, worked in a family business for a lot of years, heavy highway road construction, which morphed and evolved into real estate. I've flipped properties, had some commercial properties, et cetera. And then when the economy crashed in 2008, it really was one of those kind of life-defining moments that really gave me an opportunity. The universe forced me to move in a direction to dig a little deeper about what was I going to do with this life. So I will lovingly tell you now that I had a breakthrough, but in fairness, I had a breakdown at that moment, which really put me on a different path. And for the better part of the last decade, have been involved pretty committedly in mental health. As I mentioned, I'm the president and CEO of the National Alliance on Mental Illness for one of the largest affiliates in the state of Colorado, Arapahoe and Douglas counties. And really from doing that work, understood that people are struggling, that we have to have a place to get plugged in. In my own time of challenge and struggle, I recognized that it was just too hard to figure out where to go if you needed help. And from that realization, really got plugged into doing work in the mental health community that has continued to evolve. And I also mentioned my organization, The Connection Project, which is really focused on, you know, not just those that are chronically or persistently mentally ill, but those that struggle with mental health challenges that might just need some support in a dark time and a challenging moment in times of struggle. So I've worn a lot of hats in the last 10 years related to mental health, but it all comes together in kind of this neat, interesting package.
And actually, if I go a little deeper into that, you've done some interesting work with first responders, right? Like with police and fire. Can you tell us a little bit more about that work?
Sure. The work that we've done, and I'm going to say emergency responders, because actually our work has evolved beyond first responders, which is typically your traditional police, fire, EMS, and dispatch. We also include frontline healthcare workers, coroners, last rites individuals, wildland fire, et cetera. There are a lot of responders who show up for in our darkest days. You know, if you think about them, they show up when, you know, we're having some of our very worst moments. And really that work began back in 2017 in recognizing that, you know, the Connection Project and its goal was to simply, you know, strengthen and deepen connection with ourselves and others. And the interesting thing about that concept was, is it really was applicable to anybody. Well, the reality is, as you well know, Dave, you can't market to anybody and everybody. So we started taking, you know, a deeper look into what are the communities that are most vulnerable? What are the communities that have the highest suicidal ideation and completion rates, depression rates, anxiety, substance use and misuse disorders, et cetera, and emergency responders were at the top of the list. And now this was pre-COVID. So as we take a look forward now, you know, after what we've all collectively been through the last 2 years, I mean, the pot has only continued to boil over at an even more accelerated rate. And the people who are showing up for us in our worst times are struggling at alarming rates. So the work was really born out of seeing the need and saying, we've got to show up for these people. Now, what that has looked like and evolved has changed over the course of the last few years. But there is no question that it is a community that is really struggling.
So this is not a world that I'm familiar with, but I want to lay out my perception of it. And then I want you to tell me how right I am or how much I've got to tweak about that. So I would view the emergency responder space as an area where oftentimes rather stoic type individuals who are under a constant pressure where, you know, they are very interrupt driven. You know, things happen to them where they have to respond, and they have to be perfect in their execution of the work, or bad things happen. The other side of that, which oftentimes is sort of nature or what essentially only has to get things right once, right? A fire only has to get through once. A medical condition only has to be missed once. How much of that is sort of true, and what am I missing in the subtleties of the perception of that?
I don't think you're missing anything there. And I do think that that is a pretty accurate depiction of what happens. I think the thing to make this a little more humanized as a story is, you know, something happens catastrophic in our lives and we reach out to emergency responders to come and support us. And that may be one of the worst days of our lives that they're happening to respond to. I think where the conversation changes that most of us who are not in that field don't recognize is that happens over and over and over again, systematically throughout the course of their days, weeks, months, et cetera. And I think from that kind of always being in a crisis state, we really are expecting a lot from individuals, and we've never really given them an appropriate off-ramp to unload what they're dealing with. You know, if you think about the people that are showing up to support us, who's supporting them? And I think that's really where we jump into the conversation, in recognizing that often from that stoicism that you see, or the network that kind of becomes the amalgamation of the people who are serving us, you know, oftentimes they don't, they're not able to break confidences to go home and share with their families. And then we have families at home that, you know, are wanting to support their loved one who's a responder, and they don't have all the pieces and information either. So it's a pretty isolated sort of field to be in that kind of becomes like this close-knit community, you know, that can often look like sick people helping sick people. And that's not a good off-ramp for us to really deal with the trauma that they're dealing with day in and day out.
Okay. So for my listeners, I hope they're hearing the parallels, which is what intrigued me here, where, so we spend a lot of time in IT services and more importantly, both help desk and right. IT security, where a lot of the parallels of what you describe are exactly the same pressures that these people face. A breach happens, you're having to respond in real time to criminals entering the business, holding hostages. Obviously, the stakes may be perceived differently, but the pressures work the same way, which is why I actually wanted to talk about, like, how do organizations deal with this? if I'm and now my parallel here is I'm thinking about these cybersecurity people that are working on being response, or they're dealing with help desks, and they have these incoming crises that look exactly like what you just described from regular, I'm putting that in quotes, of, you know, physical emergency response. If I make this all cyber, it feels the same. So I guess my first question is like, so how do these organizations, if we're talking to the leaders of these orgs that look the same, how do they process this? what's the missing piece that these leaders need to start thinking about to make this situation better for their emergency responders?
Yeah, I think in your instance, the missing piece for leaders in the organizations you're working with really comes down to starting with recognizing you're not alone. I think when things happen in our lives that are traumatic, they're sad, scary, we immediately go inward and assume that we're the only person fighting this battle. And what you've just validated for us is that there are many people that are doing these same jobs day in and day out that become commonplace for them. But again, they are not commonplace events that do have some residual effect on how that affects us internally. I think recognizing we are not alone is the starting point and an invitation for people to start reframing that sometimes just being able to share about common or shared experiences with another person who understands can make a huge difference in solving that you're not alone problem. I think from there, then getting really tactical about, okay, recognizing we're not alone, what are the things that would help, you know, release the pressure for somebody or help them feel more supported in those times of need? But I have found by and large, it starts with recognizing you're not alone and being able to share and talk with other people who understand what you're going through.
Is that something placed on the individual on the front line? Is that placed on the leadership? How do you build a culture of recognizing that?
So, you know, in the emergency responder world, that normally would start culturally from leadership down. And I do think that there is a real push for things to go from employee level up, you know, the kind of the bottom up sort of approach to this. My thought is if we could have, you know, both sort of communities doing this and meeting in the middle to solve a problem, I think there is a better chance to have a flow of communication. You know, the reality is oftentimes people in leadership don't really, maybe they've done those jobs, maybe they haven't, they've ascended into these leadership roles and don't quite understand what being on the front lines is like. I think opening dialogue and communication up to actually understand what is happening day in and day out and getting some real world feedback about what this is like for people that are doing these jobs and then figuring out collectively together, how can we better serve you? Because I think recognizing you're not alone and opening lines of communication, that's not just a straight line to get there. I don't think you go from let's keep everything inside to, oh gosh, we're going to come together and have a kumbaya moment and talk about it. It doesn't work that way. But I do think that there are some approaches where you can let people, A, know that you're supported by leadership and that they are willing to, you know, offer resources to help you. You know, and I think leadership's responsibility potentially is figuring out what are those resources that help. You know, the work that I do for emergency responders is really born of tailor-made resources specifically for responders and their families. Now, I'm going to tell you, when you scratch beneath the surface in a lot of those resources, there are things that could apply to any of us, but we have tailor-made those resources to reach that audience in language they understand, from scenarios they understand. And I think what you're talking about in the IT cyber world here is the same thing. You have to put it in language that people understand, that they feel like you are talking to them. You know, and the problem with, you know, addressing mental health, and that's really what we're talking about, the elephant in the room here, is we assume traditionally that people are willing to do more, to go further, to take steps that I don't think plays out in the real world. I don't think most people are just, hey, I'm struggling, I'm going to show up and talk about my mental health. So from that perspective, I think we almost start from a deficit position and have to realize that until we can open a dialogue that encourages people to share, encourages people to talk about their collective experience, that creates this kind of camaraderie of not aloneness, I think we will continue to struggle to show up in a different way. I mean, and I think that's played out in our world. We see this playing out in different communities day in and day out.
Can you make this concrete? Like take an example or genericize an example for me of something you've done and worked with an org that wants to go down this, to start on this journey, particularly in this emergency response, and pick your favorite one. If it's a police, fire, EMS, you pick a great one and walk me through kind of how that process works very tactically.
Yeah, that's a great question. So how I have supported the emergency response community as an example. So I do a lot of work with the All Clear Foundation, allclearfoundation.org. It's a national nonprofit that is stood up by a multi-billion dollar corporation that is dedicated to supporting emergency responders. And in that instance, really what the organization has done is we have created, you know, a resource directory for responders and their loved ones that, you know, has 800 resources available. We have vetted, you know, organizations across the country that can show up and support responders in a time of need. We have developed a Responder Strong mental health curriculum in that organization that goes into agencies and trains its employees and, you know, sworn, non-sworn officers, basically on our mental health curriculum throughout the nation to better do exactly what we're talking about, to better understand what we're dealing with and how do we start having these conversations that open the floor up for people to know that they're not struggling. And then we've empowered people to go back and teach those concepts in their respective agencies. We have developed tools that responders can use on demand 24/7 that they can do a self-assessment to kind of figure out where they are and then get connected with tools and resources to plug themselves in to ways to help themselves. I think the important thing, before we get into talking about changing the system, I think an individual, if they're struggling, has to realize what are the steps that I could take on my own right now. And I know that path is not always clear, but I often remind people, getting 15 minutes of sun on your head, taking a walk, practicing some gratitude, getting enough sleep, drinking enough water, those things all by themselves can shift your mood state in a moment. I guarantee you, if you are having a really bad day and you go and get 15 minutes of sun on your head and take a walk around the block, you will feel differently. I'm not saying it's going to fix it or you're going to feel better. You will feel differently. So I think in those moments of recognizing what are things that I could empower myself to do first, easy things that we all have the capability to do for free. I think it starts there. You know, inside systems, I think, again, the system assumes, and I'm talking about the mental health system, assumes that people are willing to do more and to take more action than I think actually proves out in real life. So, you know, the thing that we've learned in the past 2 years is the demand for help far exceeds the supply. My thought is we have a real opportunity and obligation to better guide people. How do they support themselves? How do we empower ourselves? And again, I'm not saying this fixes everything, but I do think that there is, you know, we've gotten so buried in our phones and our technology and our day-to-day lives and the hustle and bustle that we forget that, you know, in a moment, I could go walk around the block and I'm going to feel better. I could go talk to a friend and say, hey, how's your day? Even if I don't talk about what I'm really dealing with, and I might feel better.
So it's a lot of culture investment from an organization perspective, right? I mean, that's sort of where it starts. Right. Is that what leadership roles have to sponsor this? Like how are the most effective ways to make that happen?
That's a great question. And I think it always does start with who are the leaders that can buy into the reality of people are struggling and we have to show up to help them in a different way. And in cultures, in some organizations, that is far easier than others. But it normally starts with people who want to be the champions of supporting the team that they support. And from that perspective, then figuring out who can they partner with, who can they plug in with. You know, in my example of All Clear Foundation, you know, part of our Responder Strong mental health curriculum training is really, it was born of being able to go inside agencies and start having conversations that shift culture. I think the thing that we have to recognize that really gets waylaid in a lot of these conversations is none of this got here overnight. And to change culturally how we relate and interact with humans while we're doing busy jobs that have critical needs as components of them, it's probably not going to get fixed overnight either. And I think the push to want to fix everything immediately is fabulous. But the reality is it doesn't happen like that. I don't think human nature responds that quickly. I don't think leadership responds that quickly. But to your question, I think it really starts with identifying who are the leaders and who are the proponents of change in an organization that can really open the door to start having more thoughtful conversation around, hey, we're struggling here and we need some help.
So what's the biggest mistake that you see with managers who may be well-intentioned, but do something that is exactly the thing they shouldn't be doing? Do you have an example of something that's not the obvious mistake that is kind of overlooked?
I think the biggest mistake managers often make is not recognizing that they need to show up to meet their team. And I think conversation both works both ways. And I think as a good manager, you know, being able to be in the trenches a little bit with your team, understand what they're going through, what they're struggling with, ask them what they need. What can I do to help you? How can I serve you? I think that not doing that is a mistake. You know, if you're not having, you know, a two-way open door conversation around what's going on in your environment, I think you're missing a real opportunity to show up and be a strong leader.
And what are those key warning signs that you want to make sure that that leaders and managers know that they should be watching out for? What are those sort of key elements to keep an eye out for?
Yeah, key elements that you might notice in your team is, has your productivity shifted? You know, has it decreased? You know, do you find that you have higher call-in rates or people that are no-shows for jobs? Is your turnover rate increasing? You know, are there things that are really kind of tactical things that you can pinpoint? And I think first and foremost is, and again, I'm not expecting managers to be therapists here, but just how engaged are you with your team? You know, if John is not as engaged as he used to be, is that an opportunity for you to say, hey, John, I've noticed you don't seem engaged. Is there anything going on? Can I do something to support you? I mean, I really subscribe to the servant leadership sort of philosophy in my life and recognizing that I am here to serve a collective and others, you know, so for me, just to say, this is how we're going to do it and go down the path is really short-sighted and not understanding, like, do people even want to be on that path? You know, so I think it goes back to what we talked about earlier is that you are not alone, but there is a real opportunity to start having, you know, more open dialogue and communication. And, you know, I think that happens individually and collectively in teams. I think that, you know, there are exercises that can be done to build rapport among teams if there's not, you know, currently rapport that is supportive or healthy. And there are people who can help. I mean, I go in and work with organizations all the time on how do we change the culture here? And again, it's not saying you did bad and you did good. It's recognizing that we can do better together.
Well, so if leaders and managers that are listening to this want to sort of start working with their organizations, what are some of the resources that you want to point them to get started?
I think you should start by looking, are there specific support resources for your industry? And the reality is, in what you're talking about, there may not be. But identifying, okay, if we're going to offer support resources, I think you have to first know with what are you trying to support? Are you thinking that maybe you have higher substance use and misuse disorders going on in your organization? Do you see people calling out more? Do you see depression among people, anxiety among people? Are they having problems with productivity? You know, are there conversations that you could start opening the door? And I'm looking beyond the traditional, let's put you into an EAP and get you some help. I mean, what are some resources that we can guide people to that you know, offer them some support? But in the organizations you're talking about, I really think it comes back to creating open lines of communication around, we're all here to serve this purpose, and each one of you is an integral part of that purpose, and ensuring that everybody feels plugged into that purpose. So as far as specific resources, I would start and look at by industry. Is there something specific to support those? And if not, then go into identifying, okay, what are the support resources we need, and looking for those.
Gotcha. And if people want to get in touch with you to have further conversations, what's the best way to do that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm always accessible and available, certainly by email. My email address is jason@realpeoplereallife.org. My organization is Connection Project, and our website is realpeoplereallife.org. You can reach me those ways. But I'm always happy to look at organizations because, again, I want to go back to the work that I do. While I may do a lot of work with emergency responders, I've also done a lot of work with youth. I've done a lot of work with middle-aged men. I've worked with a lot of entrepreneurs. And what I want to underscore in all of this is the work is the same, Dave. It may be tailor-made or nuanced to an organization, but it really it is the same. I mean, at the end of the day, as humans, I think our desire is to feel more connected to ourselves and then others. And how we get there, I think, is fairly systematic. We just have to make it invitational enough to where somebody feels represented and seen in what we're offering them.
And I'll tell you, that's exactly what I was thinking as I researched for this and said, like, the parallels to what you're talking about with emergency responders were just too striking to what we see on cybersecurity and cyber responders. And so I felt like you were exactly the right person to talk to about it. So I really appreciate you joining me today.
The pleasure is mine. I appreciate the opportunity.
Remember, if you like this kind of content, you can support it directly. Visit patreon.com/MSP Radio for our Give What You Want program. Every little bit helps, and we are supported directly by listeners like you. The Business of Tech is written and produced by me, Dave Sobel, under ethics guidelines posted at businessof.tech. Like the content? Support the show at patreon.com/MSP Radio or buy our Why Do We Care merch at businessof.tech. If you want to reach our listeners, visit mspradio.com/engage.
Part of the MSP Radio Network.
From pit lane to podium, the Las Vegas Grand Prix is providing fans a race day experience at the speed they deserve. With the help of T-Mobile for Business, our 5G advanced network solutions are powering race day operations with event-wide connectivity. From streamlined gate entry to an immersive app, giving fans blazing fast access to the sport they love. This is accelerating innovation. This is the Las Vegas Grand Prix with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Sometimes it takes a different approach to help you unlock your true potential. With Capella University's game-changing FlexPath learning format, you gain relevant skills you can apply to your career right away. Earn your degree from an accredited university and be confident in the quality of your education. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu. Capella University is accredited by the Higher Learning Commission. Learn more at capella.edu/accreditation.